If you love America, you're among friends here. ConservativeNationRadio.org.
There's no time to kill between the cradle and the grave. Father, time still takes a toll on every minute that you save. Legal tender's never gonna change the number on your days. The highest cost of living's dying, that's one everybody pays. So have it spent before you get the bill. There's no time to kill.
Welcome to Inside Tennessee on Conservative Nation Media. I'm your host, Dave Vance. Inside Tennessee is sponsored by the Tennessee Action Council, an educational organization dedicated to restoring constitutionally limited government and the Judeo-Christian values that made our country great. Visit our website at tn4action.com. That's tn4action.com. The phone number to call in and join the conversation is 718-305-7176. That's 718-305-7176. Thank you for joining us tonight. We have Mike Warner from the Montgomery County Constitution Party who will join us here in just a few minutes. We're going to talk about corrupt politicians. I know that's, kind of, repetitive there, but we're going to talk about them on a national level a little bit, and then we're going to get into what some of the things that are going on in here in Tennessee. Mike, as I mentioned, is the interim chairman for the Constitution Party in Montgomery County. And then a little later on, we're going to have Lee McGrath from the Institute for Justice with us, and Lee is going to talk about eminent domain and civil forfeiture. You may have heard about the policing for profit issue we have along I-40 here in Tennessee, where driving with cash somehow becomes a crime in this state. According to the way we currently have our law structured, that's one of the things that's happened in our state, and it's a shame. So we're going to talk about that a little bit. But I want to hit you up with a little something here. You may or may not have heard about it. The Stand Up for America website, Stand Up for America, it's standupforamericaus.org, and that's the creator of that website is retired General Paul Valley, a highly decorated veteran from the Vietnam War. He's been on Fox News and other shows like that for quite a, over the years. Very prominent, very respected man, and he's basically, he's in several articles, he's pointed out that it's time for Americans to stand up, especially America's veterans, to stand up for what's going on, not just for what they're doing in the military, but for what they're doing in the country. And what we need an American spring. Now, right now, everybody is freezing their butt off all over the state, so all over the country for that matter. And so I'm sure everybody welcomes some spring, but that's not exactly what we're talking about. We're talking about similar to what went on in Egypt in terms of standing up and just demanding. What they did in Egypt was they demanded the Muslim Brotherhood stepped down. Obviously, their military pitched in help, and I don't think that's not the goal here, but enough people in the street demanding the resignation of our current occupant of the White House, the leader of the Senate, the leader of the House, Boehner, McConnell, Reid, Pelosi, Obama, and basically just a call for all of them to step down. Now, it may sound far-fetched, but we have to do something. And so the hope is that we get enough veterans to get involved with this. Now, their kickoff for this event, and I'm hearing it's going to be called American Spring. I don't know that for a fact, but that's what I'm hearing. You can go to the website and check it out. It's going to kick off in South Carolina the 17th, 18th, and 19th of January. So that's just around the corner. So go to the website, look up the details, and see what you can find out about it. And if you're a veteran or if you know of other veterans, you'll definitely want to let them know about this. And we do have to stand up. We are going to have to take some, desperate measures. I'm not calling for anything illegal here or violent. I'm just saying we're going to have to do something out of the norm to save our country. I was listening this morning on the way into work to one of the more prominent radio hosts in Nashville, and I'm not going to say his name. But something that he said really kind of stuck with me. Really, to be honest with you, kind of surprised me and disgusted me a little bit. He made the comment that with the even with what we have going on right now, even with Obama and Obamacare and everything else, that, you know, we're strong enough, and once he's out of office, we'll recover fine. And it'll just be a blip on the screen. And I'm thinking to myself, does this guy not get it? Does he not realize that the president and his minions are fundamentally changing this country? And the Republicans aren't doing anything to really stop it. They get a little mileage out of some of the issues, but they're not really making any real efforts because you notice they haven't defunded anything. Anyway, I could rant on that all night, but we have Mike Warner on the line with us here. He just popped up in the queue. Mike, how you doing tonight?
Great. How are you doing?
I'm doing good, doing good. I appreciate you coming on the show.
Yeah, glad to be here.
And you want to talk a little bit about political corruption tonight, and I know that we could spend 2 hours easy on that. We don't have quite that long, but, hey, let's get right to it. You wanted to start, I think, at the federal level based on a recent poll, if I remember correctly.
Well, different places come up with their top 10 worst politicians and so forth. And this one put Speaker Boehner as the first one on the list. Of course, it was done in alphabetical order, but he's in the top 10 at least. And what he had done to earn that privilege. Boehner, yeah. What he'd done to earn that privilege is using what they call a toll booth strategy. Just days before moving legislation through the House, he would collect money, collect donations for his political campaigns just days before advancing it. They call it the toll booth system, so it's not taking money for getting it passed. It's just, you know, hand me some money and I'll see if I can't get it to the floor or get it out of committee or do something like that. And if that's coming from the top, you better believe it's happening elsewhere up there as well. They elect who's going to be Speaker of the House. And, you know, the question comes to mind, are they electing somebody to be speaker that will let them do these kinds of things to, you know, again, the incumbent protection type of acts that keep them up there and in power?
And, you know, and you mentioned they elect the speakers. I'm curious out of the representatives from Tennessee, I don't know this, but maybe you do. Did any of them vote against him as speaker, or is that information even available?
I don't know that it's available. I haven't seen it.
Yeah, I'd like to ask our representative that, Marsha Blackburn. Maybe that's a question for her. Did she vote for him not once but twice? That would be. I'd be curious to know the answer to that. She's got some flack lately for what she did with the vote recently. The name escapes me. Paul Ryan and Patty Murray, the little deal they made that would cut the benefits of military retirees, and she's in the military district, and she went along with that.
Yeah.
So she's catching well-deserved flack for that, I would say.
Yeah, but she doesn't spend much time up here anymore, I don't think. I think she's spending most of her time down there with the rich folks in the Nashville area. A lot of these problems could be solved with the multi-party system. The problem with the big tent situation is that the more people they try and placate to, the less any of us get our interests taken care of. And so if you only have two parties, the average human being can only handle about 7 different projects at any given time, and you multiply, you know, 300 million people with only 535 people trying to take care of all of that and only two parties where all the power and focus of attention is on really just gaining more power. The if you had a more distributed, groups of interest up there, we'd have a lot less of this kind of thing, I think.
You mean a good, strong third party?
That's what I'm talking about, or more.
At least a third, if not a fourth. But I really wouldn't want to go beyond a third, to be honest with you, in this country. I think a third is a good, strong third party, I think, would be good. You get beyond that, I don't think it would go well, but I would definitely like to see
it. Well, I think
it
would go better than what it's going now. I think if we had 30 parties, we'd be better off than what we are with two. The longer they stay in power, the more they become like each other. You don't see very many people that have been married 40, 50 years anymore. But have you ever noticed when you do see them how much alike they look?
Yeah, that's true. When you look at the voting records, especially at the federal level of the Democrats and Republicans, I mean, there's some talk about what the Republican stands for. You know, they can only be conservative and care about Constitution and blah, blah, blah. But when you look at the voting record, especially on spending.
You know, it really depends on what group they're talking about, what they, you know, I think they only talk about the Constitution on even numbered years, you know. that's the only time they bring it up, or, you know, and, they haven't, none of these bills they come up with anymore have anything relative to, you know, what's constitutional or not. They give it lip service. I know they actually do read the Constitution at the beginning, the Republicans do, in the House at the beginning of every year. They started doing that, so at least they're giving lip service to it. But every single bill should have, okay, this is Article 1, Section 8, this is where the federal government is allowed to do this. And if it isn't specified in the enumerated powers, what business have they got doing it?
Oh, well, they put it under the Elastic Clause or the Commerce Clause or one of the other clauses that they have totally, totally abused. ConservativeNationMedia.com is growing, and we couldn't think of a better way to expand our line than to give our very own Bing Fisher his very own show. Uncle Bing Fisher brings his engineer's insight and love of America to American by Design. Sunday evenings at 6 p.m. Eastern, 5 Central on ConservativeNationMedia.com. So stay with Conservative Nation Media 7 days a week, since we're making some big changes and we're just getting started. American by Design with Bing Fisher, Sundays at 6 Eastern, 5 Central, on ConservativeNationMedia.com, where America always wins. For this day, Inside Tennessee on Conservative Nation Media, I'm your host, Dave Vance. The phone number is 718-305-7176, and we're talking to Mike Warner from the Constitution Party in Montgomery County, Tennessee. Now, Mike, closer to home here in Tennessee, let's talk a little bit about the progress of the Constitution Party. I know there's I think a committee meeting coming up in reference to actually not just Constitution Party, but minor parties in Tennessee. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I haven't got any date yet. They canceled the one that we were supposed to have back in October. They were supposed to have a summer study meeting on it, and they canceled it. And they're dragging their feet. They don't want us to get access. They don't want us to build any momentum. They want to hold all the power to themselves. And the more power they get, the more they want it. That's why they're interested in making sure that the citizens don't get to vote for judges. If they can control the judges, then they can, you know, control a lot of other things. They want to control us as well. Now, we've won twice, and twice we've got the Tennessee rules for minor parties declared unconstitutional, and they're going to have to let us be on the ballot. They haven't come up with any new rules that fit the requirements of the judge's order, and I don't expect that they will. And so it kind of leaves us in limbo. Now, we have an advantage in the Constitution Party in that we don't primary our candidates. We use a convention system, and we only nominate and put out there one candidate for any given office. and districts. So it's not going to be a logistical problem for us, but it's just hard to know how to plan because we don't know what to do, and they know that. They want to keep us off balance. And I think for folks that are listening that are thinking, well, you know, I don't care about the Constitution Party. I don't care about Libertarian Party. I don't care about any of this. But remember that if what is effectively happening here is the voices of people are being negated. Interests, everybody's interests have a right to be heard. And when you've got basically a one-party system, because I know people are going to say that it's true, that it is an illusion, but it really is. There are plenty of studies that show that all it is a game. It's like a wrestling tournament, and we get a little bit of excitement, and then we're supposed to go to sleep for 2 years until the next time. And we've got to wake up and realize that if one of us is silenced, the smallest minority in the world is the minority of one, and if anybody is silenced, everybody is damaged by it.
Right. Well, as far as freedom of speech, but now we're not talking about let me ask you this. What is the requirement in the state? Do you have to have a certain number of people in your party, whatever your party might be, in order for it to be recognized as a political party?
Well, not a certain number of people. You have to maintain, they had us, you had to basically get 4,500 signatures to be on the ballot. And everything seems to be geared to the governor's race, so it's a percentage of that, and they themselves only need to get, if you're a Democrat, Republican, or Independent, you only need 25 signatures, for instance, to run for state representative. So
but you need 4,500 as a minor candidate.
That was declared unconstitutional, so that's not
right.
Going to be the deal. But they're saying, okay, well, we'll do it for 2,500. But they haven't written anything down. There are no new rules. So we don't really know.
When the ruling came down, did the ruling it didn't say that, look, you have to treat them exactly like the current parties? Or did it just said, okay, what you're doing is unconstitutional and fix it, and not really give them any guidelines or standards?
Well,
they gave them some
guidelines. They said, well, what about 2,500 signatures? And the judge indicated that in his opinion, that would still be unconstitutional in his mind. Okay, so 2,500 is still too many.
Same that they require. Whatever their requirements are, that should be the same as the third parties. Mike, I got to take a real quick break. But stay with us. Don't go away. We'll be right back on Inside Tennessee.
The Internet's official rhino hunting safari.
Molon LeVay Challenge Coins and Wares. Similar to challenge coins used by various military units, these MLCCW coins are ideal for anyone that champions the right to keep and bear arms by highlighting the Second Amendment and the Greek phrase Molon LeVay, which translated means come and take them. Come check out our pro-freedom, pro-liberty, and pro-Second Amendment coins and shirts at MLCCW.com. That's MLCCW.com.
Hi, I'm Kathy Henners, your host on Daily Roll Call on ConservativeNationMedia.com. Please join me each Friday as we talk about subjects like the Muslim Brotherhood, their goals, their agenda, and how it affects our schools, our law enforcement, and our communities. As a retired police officer, I'll give you an inside look into this issue and so much more. Don't miss it. Fridays, 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 Central, right here on ConservativeNationMedia.com.
You there, Dave? Somebody, if anyone in the Blog Talk Radio chat on Dave's show can hear me, let me know in the chat room, please. Dave has lost connectivity again there.
Are we on the air?
Mike? Yeah, this is Kurt. Okay.
Yeah, Kurt.
We had an episode like this last week when Dave lost connectivity over there, and we kind of tried to fill some dead air then, and I guess we'll do the same thing until Dave shows back up again, okay?
All right. That'll work. Yeah.
Kind of strange.
Yeah.
There. I was muted, and he unmuted me after he dropped off, so I don't know how that works. Anyway, if you know, wherever you were there, which unfortunately something shiny ran across my path here, and I don't know where you were.
I want to say that we're excited. We're growing very rapidly. The Constitution Party is the largest and fastest growing non-establishment party in the nation. And we've been growing at a rate of a new county about every 3 weeks or so. Starting. So we're making progress, and we're kind of focusing on the state more than national. We feel like we can get a lot more done with state offices. It costs so much to run a congressional campaign, and this is not a new party, but we're just getting our legs. And
okay, I'm back.
There he is.
Can you hear me?
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. All right.
Okay, we can hear
Sorry
you now.
About that. Okay. Hey, well, welcome back, everybody. Thank you for covering down on the fort again for me, Kurt.
No problem.
I appreciate that. Okay. Anyway, Mike, go ahead and finish in terms of talking about the court decision to get the minor parties on the ballot.
Well, like I said, we won it twice, and they've gone back of course, they're challenging it. They seem upset that we took it up to the federal level. But it's just like the situation with basically like the SB 250 deal. We've got too many people up there that think that the federal government is the only one that can tell us what the limits of the federal government power is. But then on the other hand, when it comes to state stuff, and their bailiwick, the who gets elected and stuff, they object to that. So it seems like they want it both ways.
Yeah. Well, so they sent it to summer study. They were supposed to have a hearing. They canceled the hearing in October. I thought that hearing had been rescheduled. I thought I saw something recently about that.
Well, I'm not aware of it. If it was, I know that they were planning it, but I haven't heard.
So, what does the Constitution Party do, and other parties for that matter, without clear guidance between now and 2014? How are they going to do it?
Well, I mean, we've already passed the date that we're supposed to be able to go pick up petitions and get to work, and we don't know what petitions that would be. The Libertarian Party in Memphis in October sued to get on the ballot for a special election, and it may be that that's what we're going to have to do too. We have people working on we have an attorney working for us on that, and they're supposed to get that worked out, but to my knowledge, that hasn't happened yet.
Okay. Well, now, if you had to do, just hypothetically, if you had to get 2,500, if it ended up being 2,500, you know, how do you think that would play in the places where we actually have Constitution parties in Tennessee, the counties that actually have parties? You think that would be feasible?
I think we would do it. I don't think it would be right. It's certainly not fair. And think about it. You know, people say, well, I'm just going to run independent. And I've thought about doing that myself, just to get the 25 signatures, doing it as independent. But when you do that, you cut the party off, because then the party isn't getting the votes that status is being on the ballot.
Ah, okay. Okay.
Okay. So, I mean, they got us coming and going. We'll do whatever we have to do. I'm sure we'll have a number of good people running, some very good conservative, constitutionally minded people that we'll have to ask first. If we're elected, we're going to have to ask, okay, is this constitutional or not? And if we vote for it and it's not, we're subject to penalties. We three times censure for voting unconstitutionally or violating our oath of office, and we can lose our party status. And that doesn't mean we can get fired, but we're signing an oath or an affidavit, a letter of commitment that says that if we are censured three times, we'll resign. And that's not enforceable under election law. But we're the only ones doing that. No one else.
Yeah, well, see, the GOP, when you do that in the GOP, that's called reaching out, trying to expand the tent, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And the bigger the tent is, the less every person in it matters.
Yeah.
You know, you're just another number, another digit on the computer. That's all you are. So it's important to have a strong, viable third party, if not a fourth party, like you said. At the very least, you think about it, the Gang of Eight, let's say that's eight senators out of 100, change things drastically up there sometimes. You don't need 51% to make a difference. You only need enough to swing things or bring attention to things that are being overlooked.
Yeah. Well, what is the filing deadline? You said is come and gone for.
No, well, not come and gone. April 4th, I think it is the deadline for filing. But starting the 3rd of January is when you pick up your petitions.
Okay,
and so the time for us to pick up our petitions is it's not past. It's just it's cutting the time we have in order to
right. So the order didn't incorporate the order did not include that they would have resolution for you guys by the date that you can, you know.
Well, it was declared unconstitutional, and they were told to do it. But since they've, since they're going back since they're not accepting it, and they're going to go back and try it again, that puts everything, you know. And they waited to the very last day to do that. The last day they could do that is when they did do that. So
you guys are going to have to do a class action suit just to get anything done.
Well, I don't know about that. I'm hoping not. But we'll do what we have to do. We have enough people. We have enough backing. We have people interested in having another voice up there. And the biggest thing to me, and the reason why people should be very interested in having us up there, is that we've got a whole lot of yahoos up there in the State House that believe that the federal government, any bill that the U.S. That Congress puts out there supersedes anything that the state does.
They've never read the Tenth Amendment.
They talk out of both sides of their mouths. If you remember in the SB 250, Kelsey said that the Tenth Amendment took second fiddle to the supremacy clause. What's the point of having a Tenth Amendment if it doesn't take precedence over the supremacy clause? The supremacy clause is all constitutional law, just about every attorney, every law school teaches, because it gives power to the judiciary the Supreme Court is the final arbiter of what's constitutional and what's not. But that's not what it says in the Constitution.
No, it's pretty clear, but they clearly don't want to do the right thing, and they don't want to make a stand. One of the worst nightmares that can fall on American today is identity theft. If it happens to you, it may take months or even longer to recover from it, if you can recover at all. Don't let it happen to you. Protect yourself in advance. Sign up today with LifeLock. LifeLock is a lot more than just your standard credit monitoring service. LifeLock helps to protect your personal information using a combination of data surveillance techniques and outstanding member service 24/7, 365. There's really nothing that comes close to LifeLock. To protect your identity with LifeLock and get 10% off their great service, go to conservativenationmedia.com and click on the LifeLock banner. Network may not cover all transactions, and the scope may vary. That's conservativenationmedia.com, then click on the LifeLock banner. You'll be very glad that you did. We're going to take a quick break. Don't go away. We'll be right back on Inside Tennessee.
Been looking for an online gathering place? You know, a familiar screen, does everything you're used to, except give you grief for being a conservative? You've got to try the Tea Party community. At TPC, you'll know how everything works from the very first minute, and you'll probably find a lot of friends who are already there. Organize, communicate, share ideas, upcoming events, pictures, and videos. The Tea Party community connects and empowers like-minded, politically conservative people like you. Sign up today at teapartycommunity.com.
Adopting a new pet is a rewarding experience. And Shelter Pets make super pets. Your new best friend will steal your heart, bring you happiness, and enrich your life for years to come. You can make a difference in the life of an animal. Adopt and bring home a Shelter Pet today. To find out more, visit theshelterpetproject.org. This message has been brought to you by the Humane Society of the United States, Maddie's Fund, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Inside Tennessee on Conservative Nation Media. I'm your host, Dave Vance. The phone number is 718-305-7176, and we're talking with Mike Warner from the Constitution Party in Montgomery County, Tennessee. Mike, I want to touch base a little bit here on or get back to, you know, you were a longtime Republican, and you made the switch to the Constitution Party, and, you know, voting record and, you know, constitutional issues and corruption issues are some of the things that led you to make the decision to leave the party. You want to touch base on that a little bit?
Absolutely. I've been Republican, voted Republican ever since I was old enough to vote. I've been doing that for over 40 years. But like a lot of people, I didn't pay that much attention. I kind of let it go. And we can't do autopilot anymore, but actually we never should have been. But about the time that Bush said that we've got to abandon free market principles to save the free market is when my nerves shot through the roof, and And I started reading, I started listening, I started paying attention, and watching what was going on. And the more I read and the more I listened, the more disturbing it got. I was supporting Lori Day and Mark Green in their campaigns during the primaries in 2012, and I had a needle under my skin. You know, they did the redistricting, and my understanding, I kept checking the state website, and it appeared that mine hadn't changed. And then I got my after the deadline was over to file to run, I got my voter registration in the mail and said that I was in Joe Pitt's district. And no one was running against him. Apparently, the GOP had made it that if he would sign off on the redistricting, they wouldn't run anybody against him.
Really?
And I kept working for Mark, and I kept working for Lori, and doing all I could do for them. And then after the primary was done, I said, you know, I just can't sit by and not give people a choice. So I went in as a write-in candidate, which, you know, you've got very little chance of success doing that, but I felt like people should have a choice. While I was campaigning in front of the early voting, I would have people come back out to get my card so they'd go back in and make sure they did it right. So it did make an impact, and at least it allowed people that were paying attention to have a choice, but, you know, without the name on the ballot, it was very difficult to do. What was most disheartening to me, I got about just under 5% of the vote.
But you started late as well.
Yeah, I did. I didn't start until after the primary. But what was most disheartening to me was to watch Lori Day's campaign and the way they did her. She had beat out the Republican Party's, fair-haired boy, so to speak, and they never forgave her for it. That and the fact that she was conservative, constitutionalist-minded, and wouldn't have bowed to pressure to do anything else, and so they let her drift in the breeze, didn't support her. After the election was over, they were bragging about having $16,000 left over in the GOP, the local GOP account, and gave some money away to some charities and things like that. But $1,000 or $2,000 would have been more than enough to make the difference for Lori Day. And I began to see that if you weren't one of the ones that was going to kiss the ring, you weren't going to get anointed by the GOP. You weren't going to have a chance, and the people that wanted the things you wanted wouldn't have a chance to have their voice heard. And so I was a member of the Tennessee Republican Assembly. I was determined at that point that fix this Republican Party, and we're going to start right here in Montgomery County, and I got elected to the board, but when I got in there, I saw more things that disturbed me. I began to realize that people don't even know who it is that's running the party, and you can't seem to get enough interest for people to even learn who that is. And those people determine ultimately.
They're not conservative either. Normally the people that are running are not conservative. They are the epitome of a rhino for most cases.
Well,
now, there's exceptions to that. There are exceptions of, you know.
It's really worse than that. Okay, it's really worse than that. The people that are up there are handpicked and put up there from the National Party, and the National Party is handpicked and ruled by about 10 white bald guys, and I'm a white bald guy, but I'm certainly not one of them. Okay, and those guys ultimately pick who you get to pick for in the general election 95 to 99% of the time. Every once in a while, there's a Mike Lee or a Cruz that gets by them, but it's very rare. And people act as though, you know, rhinos are the exception. They're not the exception. They're the rule.
They're the rule. They're the rule. Yeah, but now I will tell you one exception, and I know he's listening because his line is mic is lit up on the switchboard, and I'll tell you a rule. An exception to that rule is certainly Kurt Blackwood from Henry County, and if he wants to say anything, he's welcome to. If he wants to get into this conversation, if he doesn't want to do that,
let him
pass. He's a good man, still in the GOP, still trying to fix it there, but he's, you know.
We've got some good conservative people here in Montgomery County as well. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that they don't have the control. They don't have the power to change things. Okay, it's the state executive committee that runs everything, and when it comes up on the ballot, most people I voted for years and saw that and didn't know what it was. I don't believe most people know what it is. They don't know who they are. So anyway.
And it's not the conservatives or certainly not any paleocons running it. Speaking of paleocons, our friendly local pilot in command and GOP spokesman Duke Brooks calls himself a paleocon, and rightly so, since it's clear that anti-communism is in his DNA. His friends were parents with Joe McCarthy, Bill Buckley, and Whitaker Chambers, so what would you expect? There's no truth to the rumor that he has a dartboard with Alger Hiss's picture on it, but you can get your weekly dosage of old-school conservatism, right-wing politics, American history, and hanger flying on Radio Free America with Duke Brooks, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Central, on conservativenationmedia.com, where America always wins. You're listening to Inside Tennessee and Conservative Nation Media. The phone number is 718-305-7176. And Kurt has said nothing, so I'm assuming he has nothing to say on this.
Give me later.
Time would be best spent. Let Mike go ahead and give you his. You guys know where I stand, and you know what I'm trying to accomplish. The degree of success is the question mark, but we will find out. Okay, but go ahead, Mike.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. But anyway, I know Kurt, like him a lot, and I like the chairman of the Montgomery County GOP. There's a lot of them in there that I like. They're good conservative people, but the people are under the illusion that the people they elect to office are the ones running the party, and they couldn't be further from the truth.
No. Now, the GOP chairman in Montgomery County, that's Keith Cevada, right?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, good man. And he's. I'm thinking his hat's going to be in a ring this year, from what I understand.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
you bet.
And definitely somebody that I'm going to support.
Yeah, and again, since we don't primary our candidates, and we have an open primary, so I'll have an opportunity to vote for Keith, and I will, and I'll have an opportunity to, me personally, not the party, and the party doesn't endorse GOP candidates. Joe Carr, Alexander's got to go. We're all about that individually, and I think most of the people I know in the party feel the same way, but that's not an official position.
Right, I got you.
So,
well, we got a couple of minutes left here, so what's next for you? What's next for the Constitution Party in Montgomery County or in Tennessee in general?
Well, we're growing. We're having regular meetings. Our meeting here in Montgomery County is the last Thursday of the month at 6 p.m. at Campbell's Kitchen on Dover Road in Clarksville. I think it's 555 Dover Road. We'd like to see everybody show up there that can. We have a good group of folks, and they're serious about making a change. All of us that run in the Constitution will be Tenth Amendment people, believers, and we will vote to nullify unconstitutional federal law. We have to do that. We're committed to doing that. We commit to that in writing. So there's never going to be a question about how the Constitution Party is going to vote. If you elect a Constitution Party person, you're going to have a person that's going to vote the Constitution and obey their oath. Above all else, that's what we're going to do. And then after we're sure we're doing that, we'll look at other things. We're going to be 100% Second Amendment. We're going to be freedom of religion, freedom of speech, and all the things that the federal government is doing to eliminate those things. The establishment is all about control and power, and the more power they have, the less freedom we have. That's really all there is to it. But anyway, July 4th of 2013, I resigned from the GOP, from my position on the board and from the party. And a few days later went up, well, I guess a couple of weeks later, went up to the Constitution Party annual convention and met some really fine people. I'd had a lot of people asking me to go with the Constitution Party from immediately after the 2012 election. I resisted because I truly, truly wanted the GOP to be reformed. I wanted it to be what it says it is in its platform and never is. They just don't live up to what they say they're going to do. They rebel against what the Democrats want to do, and then they turn around and march lockstep with them.
Yeah. Well, Mike, hey, you're right on that. We've got to stand up for the Constitution, and they're not getting the job done, or not enough of them are. Well, Mike, I appreciate you coming on. Glad to have you. Hope to have you back. And I know you might be making a decision, politically speaking, not too long down the line, and we'll talk about that when the time comes. But thanks for being with us, and we will talk to you later. I appreciate you coming on.
God bless. And everybody, cpotn.com, that's the website.
Okay. Thank you, Mike. All right, don't go away. We'll be right back with Lee McGrath after this break.
Aren't you glad the so-called fairness doctrine doesn't apply here?
Hi, this is Frank Beard of ZZ Top for Rad. If you're out partying and drinking, and we all know that happens sometimes, please don't get behind the wheel. Give up the keys to a designated driver. Please don't drink and drive.
A public service message brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
Hello, I'm Jennifer Meadows, your host on Grit and Grace. Please join us every Tuesday night from 10 to 12 Eastern for an honest look at the top political and cultural issues that are affecting Americans today. That's Grit and Grace for conservative analysis that is smart and entertaining. Tuesdays, 9 to 11 p.m. Central, 10 to 12 Eastern on conservativenationmedia.com.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Inside Tennessee on Conservative Nation Media. I'm your host, Dave Vance. The phone number is 718-305-7176. And we have Lee McGrath on the line with us from the Institute of Justice, Institute for Justice. And Lee, thank you for being with us tonight.
Dave, thank you. It's my pleasure. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Happy New Year. Now, Institute for Justice, one of the main things they do is work to protect private property, whether it's eminent domain, forfeiture issues. So can you talk to us a little bit about your organization?
Absolutely. The Institute for Justice is a public interest law firm, and we protect our clients' constitutional rights. We sue the government when it violates the property rights of our clients, the speech rights, and the economic liberty rights of our clients. And we also defend school choice programs that are enacted to give parents more opportunities to send their children to the schools of their choice. But in the area of property, that's where we're best known. We represented Suzette Kilo, my colleagues did, the woman whose home was taken by eminent domain. And we started that case in the district courts in New London, Connecticut, took it to the Supreme Court of Connecticut, and eventually got to the United States Supreme Court in 2005. And there, we lost. The United States Supreme Court ruled 5-4 that the city of New London, Connecticut, could take our clients' private property, not for a road or a government building, but for someone else's private, profitable development.
Did they put any limits on that? I mean, that's wide open. That means they can take it. Basically, anybody with money can say, hey, I need your property to make some more money. And I'm not putting down people with money. Don't get me wrong. But that's pretty wide open.
They didn't put any constitutional limits. And this was the crux of the case. For the advocates of the taking, for the city argued that the majority should rule, that the city councilors, the planning commission, that they should have the power as elected officials, and that if there are any breaks, there in their eyes, the breaks are put upon them by the democratic process. This, of course, is contrary. This, of course, is contrary to the whole idea of rights. Rights exist to protect people from the wishes, the democratic wishes of the majority.
So we can vote your, you know, that essentially they were saying that a city or a county has the right to vote to take anybody's property. Pretty much just because.
That's right. And so if they have identified a plan, and if the plan produces more jobs, more tax revenue, the majority of the court said that's a public use and meets the public use requirement in the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution.
Did they put if it increases the tax base, would have to increase the tax base by a minimum percentage to make it, or it was just said, hey, if it increases it, they can do it? I mean, it sounds to me like they didn't really put any limits on it.
There are no limits on it. It is a trust. What it reflects is a trust in the democratic process that city council members will act in the best interest of individuals. And, of course, that flies in the face of what constitutional protections are all about. Constitutional protections are the limits on what people can do through the democratic process. Rights are a non-democratic tool to stop the power of democracy and to protect
right.
the individual against the exercise of the majority. The Supreme Court, the majority of the Supreme Court, 5 members, said, trust the democratic process. The minority 4 members said, don't trust the democratic process because the little guy who gets his, or the little, in this case, Suzette Kilo, who gets her property taken, doesn't have the clout and should be protected by the Constitution, and cannot rely on democratic forces to protect her property. And when I say democratic forces,
so what's happened since Kelo?
So since Kelo, and this is the magnificent thing, since Kelo, after this decision came out in June of 2005, the public went bananas, and a hot rejection of the Kelo decision was immediately identified in the press and in pollings. People realized that if the government can take your property for any flimsy reason, like a new Target or a new food, grocery store, or the possibility of more jobs or higher tax revenue, you have no property rights. Every home, nearly every home in Tennessee, would produce more taxes or more jobs if it were a gas station, a department store, a convenience store. And so the public rejected the idea, and polls show that it rejected it by about 85 to 15% of the American public.
Wow.
So to put that in context a little bit, I think your listeners would appreciate this. If you think about the debate that has been going on since Roe v. Wade, a debate about abortion, the country is a 50-50, 45-55 split on the issue of the constitutionality of a right to an abortion. Well, there's no 50-50 split when it comes to property rights. The American people thought 85 to 15 that the Kelo decision was wrong. And that was the that public rejection was the stuff to build on.
Have there been any follow-up cases where Kelo was cited? Has this been expanded is what I'm asking.
No, and to the contrary, what has happened is that state Supreme Courts and state legislators, recognizing that this decision was so unpopular, have changed their laws. Soon after the Kelo decision came out in 2005, the Ohio Supreme Court ruled unanimously that under the Ohio state constitution, it was impermissible to make a Kelo-like, force a Kelo-like sale of property. And homeowners in a suburb of Cincinnati fought off the efforts of a large private developer to take their home for a Kelo-like development. And there were some state Supreme Courts, there were other state Supreme Courts, but in addition to what was happening at the state level under the protections of a state constitution like Ohio, legislators saw the writing on the wall. 45 state legislatures, excuse me for a second, 45 state legislatures have changed their laws in response to Kelo, and the majority of those prohibit by statute the very thing that the United States Supreme Court said was constitutionally permissible. So here's a magnificent example of when the public, if there's anyone who doubts the power of the public demanding its property rights, all they have to do is look at how state legislators in one state after another realize that the American public wants its property protected.
We need to do that on a variety of subjects, and, you know, get your
very
state
good
to stand up for you like that. That would be great.
That's
Lee,
exactly
we've
right.
got to take a quick break, but we will be right back, and we'll get right back to this topic. Don't go away. After a short break, we'll be back with Inside Tennessee.
If you love America, you're among friends here. ConservativeNationRadio.org.
Good evening. For Talk Radio News Service, I'm Jeff Holtzman. The White House is aggressively pushing Congress to extend federal unemployment insurance for 3 months. The bipartisan measure, co-sponsored by Rhode Island Democrat Jack Reed and Nevada Republican Dean Heller, would revive insurance for 1.3 million Americans who saw their benefits expire on December 28th. The head of President Obama's National Economic Council, Gene Sperling, said today that passing the bill is the right thing to do.
This deserves to pass.
Liberal lawmakers in both the House and Senate blasted Obama for failing to get the measure included in the Ryan Murray budget plan that was agreed to before Congress embarked on its holiday recess. The legislation would cost roughly $6.5 billion, which Republicans want offset by spending cuts elsewhere. Sperling, however, urged Congress to pass the bill with no strings attached. The national unemployment rate fell to 7% in November, nearly a point lower than where it was at the beginning of 2013. December's rate will be announced on Friday. Jeff Holtzman, Talk Radio News Service, Washington.
Americans have known Tennessee as the volunteer state since the War of 1812. Now, Tennessee is leading the way in another major conflict. The war to keep America's identity, values, and freedoms intact. Even if you've never walked in Memphis or hiked the Blue Ridge Mountains, if you respect traditional American values, you should know about the Tennessee Action Council. Tennessee Action Council fights to preserve American values, defend our way of life, and protect the U.S. Constitution. This isn't just Tennessee's battle. It affects every American who loves our country and wants to pass the real America, unstained by progressive liberalism, along to future generations. No matter where you are in this magnificent country of ours, Tennessee Action Council is on your side and on America's side. Go to TN4Action.com. That's TN, the number 4, Action.com to volunteer for Tennessee and America. That's TN, the number 4, Action.com to stand for America now.
Welcome back to Inside Tennessee and Conservative Nation Media. I'm your host, Dave Vance. Phone number is 718-305-7176, and we are talking with Lee McGrath from the Institute for Justice. We're talking about the Kelo decision. That was the correct decision, right, Kelo?
Kelo was the decision that we lost. My colleagues argued before the Supreme Court and lost in 2005 regarding the power of government to take property for what is a public use.
Okay. And you mentioned that 45 states since that decision have basically changed their laws. And Tennessee was the first or one of the first to do that? Can you talk about that a little bit?
I think Delaware was the first. Wisconsin was up there. But Tennessee was one of the first. And like oftentimes when bills are enacted, there are some flaws. So Tennessee had a bill that was signed on June 5th, 2006. It was authored by State Representative Joel Folks, and it was a bill with good intentions, but it had a couple of flaws in it that remain to this day, and present an opportunity for today's state legislature to address.
What are those flaws?
The first flaw is that in the definition of public use, it says, Tennessee's law says, private property cannot be taken for someone else's private development, except if it's for an industrial park. And the law does not define what an industrial park is. Sorry there, Dave. And so it leaves the definition up to the condemning municipality, the condemning authority, to determine whether the property is going to be taken for an industrial park. Well, this calls into question exactly what the Kelo decision was all about. The Kelo decision, the Kelo case, was a case involving taking of modest homes for the development of an industrial park, a business campus around a research center opened by a large international pharmaceutical company. And so Tennessee took five good steps forward, but unfortunately took a step backwards.
Do you know if that was an amendment or was that part of the original text?
You know, I don't know. That's a good question.
I'm really curious because that sounds like something that, you know, and that just sounds sleazy. I'd really like to know who was behind that.
Well, it was House Bill 3450. Senate Bill 3296 in the 2005-2006 legislative session. And I suppose if we could check the legislative history on that. But this is what property rights are all about. Property rights are the determination that that property owned by an individual is inherently valuable. And even if a government official, a development organization says, look, Dave, we can hire 1,000 workers. All we need is your property. Property rights mean, sorry, the individual trumps the economic interests. Now, that's not to say that people won't cooperate. That's not to say that bargains cannot be made. That's not to say that the price can vary. What it is to say in a property right is the government cannot use its force to compel the individual to sell his property, even when politicians are claiming that jobs will come to town, that this is a critical research center, that a large auto manufacturer is just waiting to make a huge investment in Tennessee. All that gets subordinated with property rights and the individual's right to decide when and for what price and if he's going to sell his property remains with him.
You know, that reminds me of another issue we have in Tennessee, and I don't want to get too far off in the weeds on it, but we have a problem with forced annexation in Tennessee. As a matter of fact, there's an organization run by a friend of mine, Tennesseans Against Forced Annexation, and it involves metro areas basically annexing the county areas around them, and the people don't get a vote, and the county, the county thinks it's, so that's another way. I mean, it's another one of the ways. It's another attack on private property. It's another loss of political rights. Just another, you know, it's just another big government tactic that's used against.
That's exactly right. It is not that this annexation couldn't take place. It's that the annexation takes place at the command and timing that government wants it to take place. It's the force that is embedded in statutes that trumps the interests of the individual.
And so now, Tennessee, are you familiar with that particular issue in Tennessee as well, the forced annexation?
I'm not familiar with that issue in Tennessee. It's a common issue that in other states in the Midwest, because people and in rural areas, because people like to live beyond of the urban centers. They want a lifestyle that reflects certain cultural norms, respects privacy, respects their desire to just live in a big open field.
Yeah.
The encroaching metropolitan area is the the challenge to that lifestyle, and that's the tension that I sense occurs in Tennessee, and I'm familiar with it in other states.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to put you later on. I'll get with you. And I'll put you in touch with the person that runs that organization. I think you guys might have some things in common. Might even be able to do a little work together. Who knows?
Well, that sounds like fun.
Now, okay. Do you know if anybody is going to try to do something legislatively this session to fix that defect in the law here in Tennessee?
I think there's some rumblings about returning. It has been rumblings about returning to the issue of eminent domain reform. Another big flaw in Tennessee, the second big flaw in Tennessee's law that was enacted in 2006 was in the absence of a definition of blight.
And
that may sound like a funny idea, but in other states,
it's scary.
In other states, municipalities can claim that your property is just not pretty enough. In fact, it's blighted. And they can use the power of eminent domain to take your property, Dave, under their determination of what blight is. And, of course, this is a highly subjective thing, ripe for abuse and ripe for the fact that it is the condemnor, it's the municipality doing the condemnation that gets to define the terms of when you lose your property. So here again, a right is diminished by the fact that the small d democratic process gets to use its force to kick you off the property.
And I bet the standard of blight is almost a secret to the average person. And speaking of secrets, I'd like to let you in on a little secret. For those of us who love America, we're about to roll out the big guns. We can't bring serious anti-communists like Joe McCarthy, Ronald Reagan, and Barry Goldwater back to life, but we think we've found the next best thing, and it starts Thursday, January 16th. Patriot, writer, broadcaster, and conservative intellectual Lisa Richards is joining conservativenationmedia.com on the 16th of January at 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 Central, with Rock and Roll Politics. If William F. Buckley were around today, Lisa would be his favorite broadcaster, and she'll be yours too. Lisa Richards, Rock and Roll Politics, starting Thursday, January 16th at 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 Central, on conservativenationmedia.com, where America always wins. Listen Inside Tennessee on Conservative Nation Media. I'm your host, Dave Vance. The phone number is 718-305-7176, and we are talking with Lee McGrath from the Institute for Justice about eminent domain, specifically here in Tennessee. Lee, before the quick little message there, we were talking about the possibility of, or you'd heard some rumblings that they might do something to fix the flaw in the eminent domain law here in Tennessee.
That's right. So I think Dave, if your listeners are interested, the legislators who would first hear the bill serve on the Senate Judiciary Committee and the House Judiciary Committee, and those are the ones that your listeners should contact, because this type of legislation is a question of can courts protect the rights of individuals against the whims of city councils and other agencies that have eminent domain powers. So I would encourage your listeners to watch what might come out of the legislature, particularly in the area of defining taking out this ambiguity of what blight is.
Now, since it's so ambiguous, one metropolitan area could have a different definition than another, correct?
That's exactly right. And so the way to fix this is to standardize the definition and make it real. Make it people think of when they think of blight. And that is a complete breakdown of the exterior and the infrastructure of a building, to the point where it becomes a health and safety issue for the residents and possibly even the neighbors. So that's a very different formula than someone say a city planner driving by saying, you know, I don't like the color of your house. I don't like the way it sits on the lot. The paint is chipping. And by the way, this would look a heck of a lot better if it were a high-end grocery store or some other or an office complex.
Right.
And so,
right.
Forcing.
And would it include? I'm sorry.
No, please.
Would it include, in the states, do you know if any states that have passed, that have clarified the definition of blight, for instance, do they normally include in their legislation, okay, all right, you know, we have deemed your property is a, you know, meets the state definition of blight, and do they normally give them some sort of time to correct the problem, or is it just, hey,
yes, and that's,
it's blight, it's gone?
You're hitting the nail on the head, Dave. The blight really, the way to think about blight is it's a serious housing code violation. It's a nuisance. It's a fire hazard. It's disconnected and destroyed plumbing and heating. And so there are all sorts of laws that exist today that place burdens on property owners to keep their property fit for human living inhabitants.
Right.
And what a good blight law should do is say these standards that exist in municipalities and are the basis for housing codes and building codes, these should be the same standards as that we use for blight, and you should give someone the opportunity once sighted, and you have to sight them. It can't be a drive-by blight sighting. You have to actually bring them into court and get a violation sighted, give them an opportunity to rehabilitate the sighted property.
Yeah, yeah. Lee, and we've got to take a quick break. We're up against a break, but I appreciate you sticking with us through the break, and don't go away. We'll be right back after this short break on Inside Tennessee.
Hey, liberals, why don't you try rooting for your own damn country for a change?
One goat can make the difference between nourishment and hunger. One goat can make the difference between poverty and sustained income. In the war-torn areas of southern Sudan, one goat can make the difference between life and death. Find out how you can help. Visit goatsfortheoldgoat.org. That's goats, F-O-R, theoldgoat.org. Fighting hunger, one goat at a time.
Hello, I am Robert Garding of the New Wives Conservatism radio show, heard on Saturdays at 4 p.m. Eastern, 3 Central, through conservativenationmedia.com. Being on the air since 2007 from behind the silver CNN microphone of freedom, we've helped people become more informed to keep socialists out of the White House and Congress. But that work isn't over yet. Tune in Saturdays at 4 p.m. Eastern on CNN for the New Wise Conservatism radio show, the voice of reason in our unreasonable world.
Welcome back to Inside Tennessee and Conservative Nation Media. I'm your host, Dave Vance. Phone number is 718-305-7176. We are talking with Lee McGrath from the Institute for Justice. Lee, we've talked about eminent domain, how the state and or municipality can decide your property is blighted, therefore they can take it. Or, hey, based on the Kelo decision, the U.S. Supreme Court decision, well, we think this would be better for the public if it was converted into a an apartment complex, a grocery store, a restaurant, whatever, and therefore we're going to take your property. Now, you mentioned that Tennessee did address it. They left the big gaping hole of industrial parks not clearly defined, so hopefully that will be addressed. But, you know, you don't have to be – you don't necessarily – when you talk about loss of property in Tennessee – you don't have to actually own property to lose it in Tennessee. Matter of fact, you don't even have to be from Tennessee. You can be driving through Tennessee and have what a local law enforcement officer determines is a inordinate amount of cash on you, and you can lose it there as well. Can you? That's civil forfeiture, they call it, right? Or policing for profit is what we know it here, know it as here in Tennessee.
Well, that's exactly what it is, Dave, and it's a tough issue for conservatives. But it's an issue that really challenges conservatives to think about property rights. And I encourage your listeners to look at forfeiture the same way you look at eminent domain. That is, can the government take your property? And under what circumstances can it take? So forfeiture deals with crime. And in Tennessee and in most other states, you do not have to be convicted of a crime to lose your property. You can be driving on the interstate. You can be driving on a rural road. Your spouse can be using your car, and the car can be seized. As well as the cash being seized. And what makes it a civil offense is that title transfers to the state at seizure, and then you must sue your property to get it back. So you must enter litigation against your own property to get the property back. And you must, and the burden of proof shifts varies on a state by state basis, but it's up to the property holder to show that car, that cash, was not the instrument or the proceeds of a crime in civil court, regardless of what happens in criminal court.
Now, okay, let me ask you something. How long have the laws, do you know how long the laws have been like that? Because that just seems to me, you know, the opposite of innocent until proven guilty, even though it involves material stuff. It's still based on whether or not you're committing a crime. I mean, it's your property, but if you haven't committed a crime, you know, how do you, why would you, it seems insane to me that you'd have to prove you did not commit a crime.
Well,
get your property back.
Dave, you're getting at the distortion of the law over time. When it was originally created 400 years ago in England, the royals, the king, was concerned about people violating maritime and shipping laws. and it may have made some sense. Because the ship would come into port in London, and it was hard to get your hands on who the owner was, but the king and the royal police could get their hands on the ship and the cargo. So in lieu of the king being able to enforce the penalty, the criminal penalty, against the ship owner, he would take the ship and cargo almost in absentia as a punishment for violating maritime and piracy laws. That difference, that dynamic of not being able to get your hands on the criminal disappeared with the war on drugs. In the war on drugs, starting in the 80s and to this day, the law enforcement is able to get its hands on someone it suspects of engaging in illegal drugs and can get their hands on the cash and the vehicles associated with that.
Can they do that for other crimes?
They do it for other crimes, yes.
Okay, so if they suspect that you're a counterfeiter, they can, even though they don't, do they have the same leeway with the other crimes that they as they have under the war on drugs? This is the question.
They can. They can. And so it happens with DWIs. It happens with prostitution. It can happen in certain states with fleeing a police officer. So these, no one should be rewarded. There's no property right in things that you have stolen. There's no property right in things that you have so-called earned through illegal activities. But the question
right.
becomes, once the property is seized, how does the court determine whether that property was part of the crime? And so what we're trying to do in Tennessee and in other states is to say a conviction is the proper step, the proper determination, the proper way of saying that person really doesn't have a property right. When he's been convicted of the crime, then that's a pretty that's the evidence, that's the process the person deserves, that's what the ultimate loss of title should depend upon. Said differently, no one acquitted of a crime should ever lose their property.
Well, I agree. And, you know, it just seems to me like that's just so contrary to due process. I mean, you know, nobody should be deprived of anything without and to not be convicted and to lose your property. That's just – now, as Tennessee, I know we have this problem. I-40, as I understand it, most of the drugs go one way, one direction. I don't remember. I think they go – I-40 East, that's where the drugs are going. I-40 West, that's where the money's coming back. That's the story anyway. But a lot of these policing for profit incidents, obviously they involve arrest made on I-40 West.
That's exactly right. There is a great television journalist in Middle Tennessee who has done some extraordinary, gathered extraordinary information through Freedom of Information Act requests and has confronted law enforcement and published reports about it. And what he has found is that the drugs go east from Mexico and Texas to New York and Washington, D.C. and Boston. The cash goes west from New York, Boston, Washington, D.C., back to Mexico, and 90% of the stops are occurring on the cash found, the westbound cash-filled side.
Right.
Well, this calls into
question. But they're using the drug laws in order to confiscate this money, but if they were really interested in stopping drugs, wouldn't they be putting more focus on the eastbound?
That's exactly right. So the problem that exists in Tennessee and in all but nine or so states is that the state legislatures have decided that they're going to allow law enforcement to supplement their budgets with seizures related to cash and vehicles associated with crimes that have a forfeiture component. And so the local jurisdictions, police jurisdictions in Middle Tennessee get to keep that cash and supplement their budgets with that.
That's just a recipe for policing for profit right there. Got to take a quick break, but we will be right back. Let's assume that if you're listening to conservativenationmedia.com, you're a conservative. You love America just like we do, and you don't want to get caught short in case the leftist government drops the ball and leaves the country and your family unable to get the basis of life in an emergency. Since that's the case, you're going to want a supply depot to get everything from patriotic gear to survival necessities to outfit and protect you and your family. And your pipeline to those essentials is right here at conservativenationmedia.com. Just go to our website, conservativenationmedia.com, and click on the Patriot Depot banner. That will take you to the world's best-known warehouse for all your conservative and emergency survival needs. Wave your flag and be ready for whatever the future holds starting right now. Just go to conservativenationmedia.com and click on the Patriot Depot banner to join the conservative revolution where America always wins. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Whether you're on active duty, a veteran, or just admire American Armed Forces, there's no better place to get the widest variety of militaria than at Highlands Militaria. Highlands Militaria is one of America's premier distributors of Fox tactical gear and outdoor products. Veteran-owned and operated, Highlands Militaria offers new and used uniforms and insignia from World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and today. With an emphasis on airborne and special operations insignia, gear, collectibles, and uniforms. If you need to replace a cherished badge or unit patch, or just want to gear up for your next outdoor adventure, go to Highlands Militaria at stores.ebay.com/Highlands-Militaria, where you'll find the best supply of the military gear you need. Shipping is always free with one-day handling time, and your satisfaction is guaranteed. Highlands Militaria at stores.ebay.com/Highlands-Militaria, and thank you for your service.
First thing I remember knowing was a lonesome whistle blowing and a youngin's dream of growing up to ride on a freight train leaving town, not knowing where I'm bound, and no one could change my mind but Mama tried.
Welcome back to Inside Tennessee on Conservative Nation Media. I'm your host, Dave Vance. The phone number is 718-305-7176, and we're talking with Lee McGrath from the Institute for Justice. We were talking about what's known as policing for profit here in Tennessee. It's a civil forfeiture. And just to clear up here, and Lee, I know you'll probably want to hit this a little bit. You know, by no means are we suggesting that people should be allowed to go down I-40 East, sell drugs, and come back I-40 West with the money. That's not what we're talking about here. But, you know, the police force, you know, I think most police are in it for the right reasons, but not necessarily everybody that's a police officer has got the best judgment. And the laws are kind of stacked to where, well, you mentioned the fact that they're allowed to use these laws, they're allowed to use civil forfeiture to fund their department. So that's, you know, that's kind of a temptation probably for a lot of them. Most departments are probably strapped for cash.
Dave, that's right. And, you know, there's one thing that people who believe in free markets and conservatives and constitutionalists and libertarians know in their hearts, and that is that incentives matter, that the human being will respond to things that to rewards, and that's one of the beauties of capitalism in that the universal good can come about by people responding to the financial rewards of capitalism. Well, I think that's excellent in the private economy, but I don't think that is the basis for running a police department. That with the force, the power that law enforcement has to take away people's liberty, we should remove from law enforcement incentives that are private sector incentives, profit incentives, and instead reward them with a salary and a budget perhaps a bonus for admirable and courageous behavior, but not fund their operations through day in and day out policing.
Right, and that could even be, you know, granted, I live in outside Dover, Tennessee. Dover, Tennessee is one of the well-known speed traps in the state. I think it's ranked nationally as a speed trap. And, you know, it's pretty obvious that that's how the city, that's one of the methods that it funds itself with, not the only one, but, you know, if you create an incentive, incentives often lead them, you know, tend to lead themselves to abuse sometimes. So
that's absolutely right. I think everyone has enjoyed the chuckle of driving down a highway, regardless of what state you're in, at the end of a month, and you see the police cars lined up giving speeding tickets, and it's a good joke because everybody knows what's going on. The budget is being supplemented. Well, the joke ends when it comes to forfeiture, because this is speeding tickets on steroids. We have some numbers that in a period of about 8 years in Tennessee, local law enforcement teamed with feds to bring in $44 million. And there's a certain policing strategy known as multi-jurisdictional policing, in which agencies will lend their law enforcement officers, but not pay them, and force them to cover their costs through what they stop and seize on the highways and roads. This is going.
Say that again. They'll do what now?
Multi-jurisdictional police forces are common in many states, including Tennessee. And in principle, it is a sound way of thinking about stopping drugs, because a drug dealer is not going to stop at the border and say, "Oh, I'm not going across the border into another jurisdiction, a county, a different town."
Right.
And so, so counties will lend local law enforcement on the town, municipal, and county level will lend officers to a multi-jurisdictional task force and say, "You can have Officer Jones, you can have Officer Smith. We'll lend them to you for a year. We'll lend them, we'll even let you use the car for a year." But Officer Jones and Officer Smith don't get paid, don't have a budget that comes with them. And so they have the incentive of going out and making stops and seizing cash and focusing on the cash and not the drugs, so as a means to funding the multi-jurisdictional task force.
That's almost like a bounty hunter.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And it takes, and I think it is detrimental to Officer Jones and Officer Smith. It turns them, the old joke about lawyers is there are certain law firms that you eat what you kill. Well, the idea is that if you don't win cases, you don't get paid. And
right.
And this system of funding multi-jurisdictional task forces in Tennessee and other states is at its core problematic because it's an eat what you kill, police for profit mentality.
And I bet you most people, I know I wasn't aware of that, and I bet you most people are not. Let's go to Kurt. I think he might have a question for us. Kurt, you have a question or a comment?
As a matter of fact, I do. Mr. McCree, I just hit my hot button there with this, what did you call it? The
multi-jurisdictional task force?
Multi-jurisdictional task force. I had not heard that phraseology or designation for it until now. And until I heard that, I didn't know what we have here in this area. There is something called the 24th Judicial District Drug Task Force. And it has been the subject of a lot of flap. And I had the good fortune to meet a young man recently who is going to run for a particular political office in this area, and I'm not going to call the man's name or the office because he's not ready to officially launch his campaign for business reasons for another couple of weeks yet. But it has to do with just this very issue. It's what caused him to decide to run. And this young fellow has some very, very impressive credentials. But I did not know that that's how that is set up, that's how they make their money, literally, that they're dependent on what they do out there as that drug task force, that they're labeled. And that's how they get paid. I did not realize that. This is a bounty hunter. Bounty hunter works for me, and my thought on that. Yeah, that's good information. And Lee, I'll be putting this fellow in touch with you for additional information on this situation as soon as he announces his candidacy. Okay.
Well, Kurt, that would be terrific. And the good news is that I think some state legislators are taking note of this, thanks to the reporting of Phil Williams in Middle Tennessee. And
I thought that's who we were talking about.
And so I've heard the 24th, that name rings a bell. I haven't researched that division. But I can tell you that the chief of police in Rochester, Minnesota, came and testified about this issue to the Minnesota state legislature a couple of years ago. And he asked legislators to stop this type of funding. And what he said is that put yourself in the shoes of a police officer, and you see a drug transaction go down, and the cash goes in one direction and the drugs go in another direction. Who should the police officer go after? Well, if a city council or a sheriff's commission or a board decides that it's not going to fund the task force, it implicitly has told the police officer, go after the cash. Don't worry what those drugs are going to do to the ultimate user of them. Don't worry about public health. Go after the cash. And so by a funding decision, he observed, priorities are being set about public safety.
Wow, that's just one more problem that I didn't realize we had that we need to fix. But, you know, even with all the problems, America is still the freest country on earth. And for those of us who love America, know that the Constitution is a reason for our liberties. ConservativeNationMedia.com isn't going to let those leftists in D.C. take our freedom away. And our constitutional expert, Matthew Opalowski, is leading the charge. Join Matthew every Thursday night at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 Central, for the Liberty and Constitution community to learn about our rights and freedoms under the greatest governing document of all time and what you can do to protect your liberty under the Bill of Rights. The Liberty and Constitution Committee with Matthew Opalowski, Thursdays at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 Central on ConservativeNationMedia.com, where America always wins. Lee, do you know in Tennessee, is there any legislation pending to deal with this? Because I know this was brought up about a year ago, because I remember the video you're talking about. And, you know, policing for profit was pretty hot there for a while. I'm not aware that they did anything about it. Do you know if anything's pending in the legislature?
I do know that there was a joint committee hearing held in December by of both House and Senate members, and they recognized that. That the status quo is unsustainable, that it is putting law enforcement agents in an untenable, unfair position, and it is putting citizens, those of Tennessee and those visiting Tennessee, in dubious situations in which their rights are really, their property rights are being radically diminished because of of funding. So I would encourage listeners to follow follow the hearings and get involved with the state legislature as it relates to forfeiture reform. The beauty of what this reporter has done is that he has shown a light on a problem, and it hits Americans that there's something wrong, and it appeals to their sense of fairness and their appeals to their sense of rights. And at its core, when you make that cultural identification, when you shine that light, special interests always lose out when you appeal to a constitutional right about the limits on government and the protection of freedom.
You know, a few minutes ago you mentioned the, I think, $400 million that the state of Tennessee and the feds confiscated totally in total last year or within the last few years. I have a question for you in reference, and I'll have to do this after the break, but here's the question. You can think about it a little bit, and we can talk about it right after the break. How many of those cases involved convictions? I'm just wondering if that material is available. Anyway, got to take a quick break. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
If you love America, you're among friends here.
Dr. Martin Luther King said, "Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere, and the worst injustice imaginable is the wrongful conviction of an innocent person." I'm Sam Thurman, host of A Just Cause Coast to Coast, Tuesdays 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 Central, on conservativenationmedia.com. We take a look at what happens when innocent people go to jail as a result of bad evidence, wrongful prosecution, and dishonest witnesses. We use real cases of actual Americans who've been wrongfully convicted. A Just Cause Coast to Coast, Tuesdays 8 Eastern, 7 Central, conservativenationmedia.com.
Silver wings shining in the sunlight, roaring engines headed somewhere in flight.
Welcome back to Inside Tennessee on Conservative Nation Media. I'm your host, Dave Vance. The phone number is 718-305-7176. And we're talking with Lee McGrath from the Institute for Justice. We are talking about policing for profit, as we know it here in Tennessee, also called civil forfeiture or asset forfeiture. Lee, I asked you a question right before the break, and I know you probably don't have these numbers, but maybe you have some idea of all the, I think, $400 million that was recently collected by the state and by the feds. Of that collected, do we know what percentage of those cases resulted in actual criminal conviction for drugs?
Dave, I may have misspoken, because the number is not 400 million, but 44 million is the number that I gave you before.
Oh, okay.
But still a large number, averaging nearly $5 million a year on a program that is done in collaboration with the federal government. And then we have some statistics, and these are really harder to get. Our last statistic was from 2003 regarding state forfeitures, and that was $15 million. So to be very conservative, what we're talking about is roughly $20 million a year, in which, one, reporting is very bad, so we don't know exactly whether a conviction, whether a charge has ever been made, or a
really?
Conviction has been made, or whether law enforcement just took the instrument or the proceeds and said, "We'll drive away Mr. Truck Driver, Mr. Car Driver, and forego any claims that you might have to get back your cash. So Tennessee, first and foremost, must improve the quality of the information, and then second, it must address what happens when priorities of law enforcement are distorted at the expense of the property rights of citizens and people traveling through the state.
Well, I'm just curious, too. You know, some of those cases that we saw on that video involved people from out of state.
Yes.
Have there been any other states, for instance, have there been maybe, let's say, legal nasty grams maybe sent to our state from other states in reference to this? You know if there's been anything like that?
Well, I don't know about legal nasty grams. I will tell you that in Georgia, there is a recognition that Georgia has a serious problem in which law enforcement is engaged in similar activities, but given its geographic center, Georgia as a hub between ports in New Orleans, ports in Savannah, ports in Florida, the numbers are significantly larger than they are in Tennessee. And it has reached the point, thanks to some reporting by the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and other media services, in which the governor has and the Speaker of the House have committed to enact improvements, at least at the very minimum, on getting better information about what exactly is going on in Georgia. Where are these proceeds coming from, and how are they being used? This information is key because we do know something about forfeiture in some detail in Minnesota. Minnesota has very extensive reporting requirements, and although it is not on a major, transportation center the way Atlanta is, or the way Interstate 40 is through Tennessee. What we do know in Minnesota is that the myth of large drug transactions isn't very true. That the average seizure in Minnesota is roughly $1,000. And 95% of all seizures are less than $5,000. So law enforcement in Minnesota has attempted to say this is a valuable tool to stop big Colombian drug lords from selling large amounts of drugs to children and young adults and others in Minnesota. But the reality is, thanks to the information that has been collected in the last couple of years, we now know that these seizures are not tens of thousands of dollars, that they're not big busts, that they tend to be overwhelmingly very modest seizures.
What about in Tennessee?
In Tennessee, we don't have the data. Tennessee needs to improve its reporting requirements. There is no reporting requirement, even though the law allows the law enforcement to keep 100% of the property forfeited. And so, in essence, what the state legislature in Tennessee has done, it has abdicated its responsibility to raise and appropriate funds and set the priorities. And what it has done is just told the law enforcement, go out, seize whatever you can, keep the profits, use it however, those proceeds however you want, and don't tell us about it. This is a true abdication of the responsibility of the state legislature to to oversee how public funds are being used.
Do what you have to do, but don't tell me. I don't want to know.
That's it. And don't give me any indication as to the efficacy of your programs. Are you making a dent in a reduction of crime? Are you making a dent in deaths and overdoses? Just keep the proceeds, and we'll trust you, but don't tell us.
Wow.
But let's be clear, Dave, I think the key, though, is we've talked a lot about Tennessee today, and I think you have a Tennessee-based audience, so that has been our focus. But I don't want to be a carpetbagger coming in and saying this is a problem unique to Tennessee. Really, there is only one state that has gotten it right, and that is North Carolina. The other 49 states, Tennessee and the other 48, maintain this system in which your property goes into civil court, your person goes into criminal court. What the people of North Carolina have done is gotten rid of the entire civil process, and they've replaced it with criminal forfeiture. And so that means if you get stopped in North Carolina and a whole bunch of cash gets seized and your car gets seized, well, the prosecutors in Raleigh or Chapel Hill, they must convict you. They must persuade a jury to convict you. They must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that there is a crime that you've committed. And that's the prerequisite to then losing title to the car and the proceeds that were seized.
Yeah, and that's the way it should be. Now, I may have asked you this already, or you may not have this information. I know you said it happened kind of over time, but do you know when Tennessee started doing this, or when most of the other states started using the civil avenue in order to, take the cash?
It was... it became popular on a relatively minor scale during Prohibition, in that law enforcement was stopping illegal sales and deliveries of alcohol, and using forfeiture law as a way of ripping the proceeds out of those illegal activities. But it really kicks in a big way starting in the 1980s.
And that's what that's kind of what I thought. Hey, we've only got about a minute of live time left here. So if you want to make a plug for your organization or give people information about a website, let's go ahead and do that. And then I'd ask if you stay on the line for a minute after the live portion ends, if you could.
Well, Dave, the Institute for Justice is a public interest law firm. And our website is a very simple one. It's just ij.org. We have about 35 lawyers in 6 offices across the country. And our single mission is to protect people's constitutional rights. We do this in the area of property rights and free speech and economic liberty. And we don't charge our clients any money to do it. And that allows us to take cases that are compelling and that we believe can advance the law to greater constitutional protection of every American's God-given rights.
Lee, I've got 10 seconds left. I want to thank you for coming on the show. I want to thank you for what you do. And I'd definitely like to have you back. And if you'll stay with me, we'll talk a little bit.
Dave, thank you.